Morning, Mr. Estrada.
Thank you, Chief Judge Santel, and may it please the court. In 2009, this court largely affirmed a sweeping RICO injunction that effectively placed the entire tobacco industry under judicial supervision. 1 month after this court's ruling, Congress passed its own comprehensive regulatory framework.
Cutting to the chase, the logic of your position in this case completely escapes me. As I understand the setup for this, and I think this is a given, this district court held and this court affirmed that your client didn't obey the law and was therefore subject to a RICO injunction. Now, a month after that, starting a month after this, you come back in and say, we don't need to be enjoined because there's a new law. You're in here because you didn't obey the old law. Why would not this logic say there could never be a RICO injunction?
I think it would be useful to start by highlighting the standard that you set forth for this particular section of RICO under Section 1964A, Judge Santel, because I think it is a somewhat unusual case, but it is dispositive in this case. You may recall that this case has been in this court. This is the third time.
I don't think Judge Brown or I are likely to forget that this case has been in this court.
Nor I, Judge Santel. But the issue is the government advisedly chose the narrowest possible plank to come into court because they wanted a bench trial and they wanted a very expeditious sort of process without a jury trial. And
what was wrong with my analysis of where we are now without going back through things that we all know?
The standard that you set forth in the opinion has two components on the likelihood of future violations, which is the essential condition for the application of RICO. One of them is that the defendants retain the inclination or the desire to violate the law, and the second one is that they retain the ability to do so. And this is from page 1133 of your last opinion. Now, the issue in the last appeal was whether the efforts that had been
undertaken. That would seem at most to go to a reason why you would go to the district court and try to make a showing for the lifting of the injunction. You're coming in here saying there's no jurisdiction.
Well,
now, your client is here because they won't obey the law. And to complicate things, and you try to poo-poo this, but to complicate things, you're trying to get that law stricken that you say is the reason why she no longer has jurisdiction. You've got other litigation for the same parties trying to get rid of the law.
We take as a given the first proposition of your statement, which is, as she once again said in this order, that the defendants had been adjudicated in 2006 to have an inclination to violate the law. That's not what we're disputing. But just to give you a simple hypothetical, suppose that it is beyond peradventure that I am a car thief who enjoys joyriding, and after I'm adjudicated to be a car thief that does those things, I am placed under house arrest. I am watched at all times, and I no longer have the ability, even if I sit in my living room dreaming of all the Porsches that I would like to be stealing. And the question here is whether the district court committed legal error in failing to even examine any part of the detailed framework that Congress put in place
Let me deal with your hypothetical. If there's evidence that in the past you've broken out of the house, i.e., you violated your confinement, then would your hypothetical be different?
Yes.
Then the injunction should remain.
No, but the dispositive distinction here is that all of the arguments that you considered in the past really had to do with an inclination to violate the law, but not with the evasion of that sort of system. If the government had come in here, Silverman.
You have this finding in this case that you, which you took up last time, that your clients had tried to evade the MSA.
Right. And what the district court and this court both said was that that was a not easily enforceable agreement by the states that lacked all of the resources. But if I could just make a little
Let me go to the fact-finding. This is what's puzzling. You have argued, this is a subtle case in this sense. Isn't this really a case of confluence of two different doctrines, the voluntary compliance and the intervening legislation? Well, don't we have to think of both together, really?
But I think the voluntary compliance goes to the inclination part. But the part that has never been examined by the district court is whether any detail of the framework actually bears on our ability to do these things. Let me give you two examples.
Well, let me push you on the voluntary compliance. It doesn't. If there is a finding that the defendant will not comply or has shown an inclination not to comply, does it matter then as to how coextensive the new regulation is?
It does, but that's a question that I would have loved to argue with the district court, right? If the answer is that not all of this really does ensure that you're under lock and key, that is an argument that what one can intelligently have about these issues. But if I could just go back to two examples about this very statute. This very statute says you may not. It is illegal for you to use the terms lights and low tar. You may not. You may use some implied health claims in the future. If you come to the FDA, we looked at your evidence and we approve them.
Did you come to the district court and move to modify the injunction because of that?
We highlighted this aspect of the inconsistency.
Yes or no question.
Yes, we did.
You did? Where is the motion to modify the injunction to reflect that change?
It is the very motion under review. We said that it bore on subject matter.
Under review was to get rid of the injunction, was it?
On two grounds. One of them was
to get rid of it, not to modify it, but to get rid of it.
Yes. Right. But
now,
we said at the very least.
Did you move to modify that particular
provision? We argued in the alternative that at the very least there were aspects of the injunction that had to be jettisoned. This was one of them. Correct the statements was the second one. And on correct the statements, again, we could have a world in which we are required under this injunction, which the district court refused to modify, to make corrective statements about light products.
This brings me back to my earlier question, is what do you do with the language of the statute? And I'm ellipsing it a little, but nothing in the statute, the amendment, shall be construed to affect any action pending in federal, state, or tribal court.
I think that consistent with the Congress's practice after Landgraf, that is a subject matter that is addressed to the applicable rules of substantive law. If you have a tort case, it doesn't change, you know, the rules that actually apply to pending cases.
Right, that's fine. So far, so good. But you said in the alternative you were asking for that substantive change, weren't you?
All right. But the question then is whether you read the word affect in that section so broadly that the district court is actually disqualified from even considering it, even if he thought it was highly relevant to the ability of the defendants going forward to violate the law.
It certainly becomes hard to fault the court for not modifying in light of it. But the second question I have is, how can you say that it leaves substantive law in the pending cases unchanged but deprives the court of jurisdiction?
Because
the Congress is saying you can still do substantive what you've been doing, but you no longer have jurisdiction to do it?
The statute has an effect in the real world as to how things are going to happen, which is not necessarily.
In the real world, if you're going to do something substantively, the court is, they have to have jurisdiction to do it.
But they are.
You're saying that this statute deprives them of jurisdiction, but doesn't change, but they can still do things substantively?
Because it deprives them of jurisdiction under an extant body of law that antecedent this law. And if that body of law says that if certain conditions are met, jurisdiction ceases, then you don't need a new substantive rule of law in this statute to examine whether the antecedent body of law actually gets that.
Assuming you're correct about that, I have several questions concerning the areas where you're really troubled, the specific modifications or specific problems in the injunction that you point to. One was the corrective statements, as I recall.
That was going to be my next example, Judge Silverman.
But let me ask you a question about that. You point out that it would be inappropriate for the district judge to try to deal with corrective statements made other than in the advertising context. Is that correct? You did make that argument in the brief.
Well, yes.
Suppose then the president of the company went on television, was being interviewed on Meet the Press, and he said, look, this notion that cigarettes cause cancer is ridiculous. I don't believe it, and whatever we say in our advertising, I personally don't believe it. Are you saying the district judge would not have any authority to deal with that?
Well, I think it depends to the answer on whether jurisdiction subsists. But if I could bring you back to
I'm dealing only with your most specific question about the modifications, your fallback argument.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, if there's no jurisdiction, you win all across the board. But your chances of that do not strike me as all that wonderful.
The question, Judge Silberman, is who has the authority to act on that? Under the new statute, if there are claims of that nature made under Section 903 of the statute, the entire product is considered misbranded, which deals with a...
You mean his statement on Meet the Press would be misbranding?
It says, this is subsection 7 at page 129A of the appendix, one of the reasons that causes a product to become misbranded is if in the case of any tobacco product distributed or offered for sale in any state, its advertising is false or misleading in any particular, or is old or distributed. And
but
if
the basic argument was that in the case against which the injunction was issued, the court was limited to advertising. So therefore, it couldn't reach corrective statements such as the hypothetical I gave. And
no,
that
but,
didn't seem to be very
no,
crazy.
But keep in mind that the
now
last
you're making
time
a separate argument, which is the government, the FDA could have reached that, even whether or not the district judge could. That's a separate argument.
But I think it is useful just
to understand the argument. Okay, now here's another question on the primary jurisdiction question.
Uh-huh.
I was rather puzzled about that because why don't we have FDA right in front of us?
I think that
and you know. I suspect, with your intimate knowledge of the unitary executive, exactly what I'm getting at.
Oh, yes, but actually...
Because most of the primary jurisdiction cases we know about all involve an independent regulatory agency.
Let me ask...
Or two private parties suing, and then a question of what a government aid. Here you have the government suing, and the government includes FDA.
Yes, but this is a question not of the unitary executive, but of the will of Congress. If I could just...
But no, primary jurisdiction as a concept is always based on a certain assumptions based on the superiority of the independent regulatory agency.
And on the desirability that Congress has expressed in statutory law for uniformity. If you looked at your own decision in the Kappelman case...
which you is have uniformity here because you have... the Justice Department representing both the Justice Department and FDA.
But this is really not so much a question of the unitary executive, Judge Silberman. If Congress passes a statute that purports to be a comprehensive framework for the regulation of an industry and provides that things that happen in that framework are subject to judicial review in accordance with the APA under certain conditions, which this statute does, every agency in the law that is a part of the executive, would love to have the ability to double dip. Anything you say is arbitrary and capricious. Gee, we have the back of the pocket injunction.
Any case where we have come in on a litigation that's gone to judgment and has an injunction and then come in and said primary jurisdiction oust the jurisdiction
no.
existing case?
No, but I think...
Particularly, do we have any statute where it has said that nothing in the statute will be construed to affect any action pending in federal, state, or tribal court where we've come in and said that?
No, but there is a question as to whether that addresses the substantive...
You're talking about congressional intent. The congressional intent we're most interested in is what they put in the statute. And that.
Yeah, and my question is, have you ever seen a case where primary jurisdiction was applied in a situation where you have two executive agencies coming in and suing together? There is no such case.
I can't think of one.
I know the
but,
case. There is no such case.
But let me give you a case that is very close to what we have here, which is the Kaplan case from your own court. And that was a case in which the alleged suit was based on the transportation of hazardous materials on a Delta Airlines flight. Somebody sued saying, I was not aware of that, I was contacted, I've been exposed, etc. A year after all of this goes on, and one of his remedies is, I want an injunction, a DCA, telling me that if I'm boarding Delta Airlines or the airlines, there may be hazardous waste. Congress has passed a statute dealing with the hazardous waste question and how it can be transported in airlines. This court holds that the nature of the injunction that was being sought was in the nature of a legislative rule to warn the public, and that Congress's intervention in passing a new statute and assigning these duties to the FAA.
Who was the plaintiff in that case?
It was a private individual.
That's the problem.
I did not say that this actually addressed that point. It was addressed to the separate point about whether it is consistent with how things generally work to have alternative dueling frameworks of regulation by injunction and by an agency that has been given all these other tools by Congress.
Had there been an injunction in that case already pending when the events under the regulatory scheme took place?
No.
No.
We have to assume
so
FDA.
You said that case was close to this one. That case actually wasn't remotely close to this one.
No, it was remotely close to it in the nature of the relief that the courts were being asked to grant, and in the inference that the court knew from the enactment of the new law. If I could go back to the question of corrective statements, when the issue was last before the court, there was a significant dispute between the parties as to whether the statements were permissible at all because they were backward-looking, or they were permissible because on some other theory. Now, the government took the position, which this court did not accept, that it was permissible to eradicate the impressions that remain from old advertising and past frauds. The position that this court did accept was that it was permissible to have them in principle, if factual.
To be an answer to your question, if not, counsel is over his time. And
may I ask a question?
My colleagues have further questions, they may ask them.
I have a question.
Yes.
If the district judge had had a hearing specifically directed to your disposition to obey the new statute, didn't rely on the 2006 finding, but had a new hearing on that issue, decided, I am still of the view, as a finding, as a matter of fact, that the defendant will not necessarily comply with the new statute. Isn't that a fact finding that we must absolutely defer to?
Yes, but it's not a fact finding that
is. So that's the end. That would be the end of your case, right?
No, because it's not a fact finding that addresses the other aspect of this problem, which is, you know, the one that I started with whether, regardless of this position, the current regulatory environment renders it unlikely that even if completely disposed with a full heart to violate the law at every opportunity, that we would have opportunities to do so, which I think is the question that this court framed in its last analysis. And the problem was failure to examine the regulatory structure at all to see if it hinders any part of the defendant's activities. So I was not arguing with the court's conclusion that we are black-hearted people. You know, the question is, take that as a given and tell me whether the regulatory environment changes our ability to act on that. It was a question that was part of this court's analysis and was never asked.
One other question I have with respect to the colors of, you know, the gold and silver.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't it a potential legitimate concern that that would be, depending on what evidence would be produced, a subtle way of advertising light tar?
Well, it was one that was brought to the attention of the FDA, and the FDA very promptly acted on it to get all relevant information. Fact is that gold, you know, the cigarettes in the gold packs and the cigarettes in the red pack are not the same cigarettes, and people are looking for different types of products, they must have some fashion of finding, you know, the product based on the trade dress to which they are accustomed. Can one make the accusation that that is a subterfuge? Of course one can. That's why the FDA is investigating it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, I'll try to keep things brief. What the defendants did here was to ask the district court to reverse its finding that they are like.
I have one question.
Sure.
Is it your view that there is no conceivable statute that would have mooted this case?
I don't believe that's our position. I mean, we're like this.
No. Is it your view now that no conceivable statute would moot this case?
This is not really a mootness case.
Because, of course it's a mootness case.
Well, the defendants in the reply brief basically acknowledge that this boils down to a question of whether they're likely to commit future RICO violations.
No. Wait. No, that is not the defendant's position. That's the position I was trying to torture them in on, but that is not their position. Their position, there's an objective legal standard here that at a certain point a statute could be articulated, which makes it inconceivable that no matter what their objective and motivation is, that they would violate the law.
It's hard for me to imagine such a statute, given.
So your view is that no statute could make this case move.
If they were to repeal. What they rely on are cases like Log Cabin Republicans, where they repealed the statute that was being challenged.
Suppose there was a statute that said the cigarette companies are free to do whatever they want to. People have had plenty of warnings. Would that not moot this case?
If it was something that did not, with sort of eliminated restrictions on tobacco companies' marketing, maybe that, but that's.
All right. So then your answer to Judge Silverman's original question should have been a simple no, shouldn't it? It's not your position.
My point is that it's hard for me to imagine.
Well, how about going the other way? Is there a statute that could be restrictive enough to move the injunction?
Again, it's very hard for me to imagine it, given defendants' repeated violations. You know, the defendants committed their massive fraud on the American public, not because there weren't statutes in place making it illegal. They committed that fraud.
Maybe because of the RICO statute, which everybody knew back in the 50s meant what it did? No.
Not just the RICO
statute. It didn't even exist then.
It was the federal mail and wire fraud statutes. It was the existing prohibitions on false and misleading advertising in the FTCA Act, which have existed since the 1930s, I believe. It was the master settlement agreement, which they repeatedly violated.
Well, is violation of the advertising statute a RICO offense? Is that a predicate offense? You had to have the mail and wire fraud, didn't you?
Yes. For the RICO offenses in this case, but their falsehoods also violated, you know, other statutes. You know, they committed fraud. Fraud violates a whole range of statutes. The RICO violations, the predicate violations we relied on here, were mail and wire fraud statutes. But fraud is sort of has always been illegal, and that's what they committed here.
But is it fair to say that this, as I characterized originally, is a confluence of both the objective criteria for mootness as well as the subjective? That is to say, there is a voluntary compliance aspect of this as well as an objective aspect of it, too, that they combine.
I mean, I think their basic claim here is that they're going to voluntarily comply with the Tobacco Control Act.
Voluntary, and they emphasize the objective, but I think both are present.
Yeah.
Anyway, that does it for me, sir.
Okay. Is there any other questions?
If there's no further questions, I think we have
Thank you.
Point, counsel. The case will be submitted.